Welcome back to the Government Huddle podcast, guys. I'm your host, Brian Chittister, and I'm sure you guys are all feeling this too. 2025 is certainly picking up momentum. It has not slowed down since the new year. In fact, it's only gotten faster. And I think we've had some of our best guests back to back to back this year. So I'm excited for the content we've been putting out. If you guys have enjoyed it, please hit subscribe, leave a review. And if this is your first time listening, thanks for joining. You're definitely in for another strong one as well. I always love when we have a CEO on the show. Getting perspective from everyone is kind of what I'm really anxious to do at all levels. And I think our guest today is going to help us. Joining me today is Larry Katzman. He is the Chief Executive Officer at AIS, Applied Information Sciences. And he's going to tell, he was actually, before we hit record, he was telling me a little bit about the meaning behind the name. I'm sure he can give some perspective there. Larry, thanks so much for being here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me and for setting the stage to only let your audience down by saying you've had some of the best guests back to back.
I like to put pressure on my guests, Larry. That's how we hit that bar. When I was kind of getting ready for this podcast, I think about individuals in CEO roles. I always think, like, I'm not a CEO myself, but like these are my kind of people, type A people. I drive other people crazy sometimes with my type A. My wife and I are both type A, so we get to drive each other crazy. But I was always like, people ask me about my personality. It's like, I was the guy that was like, you know what, screw it. Give me this and I'll just do it for the group when I was in college or high school, whatever. That was just my personality. And what I've learned over my career, and this won't be a surprise to you, nor will it be a surprise to a lot of the people listening, that doesn't scale real well when you're trying to run a business, when you're trying to be effective in your career. And it was something I was really intentional about as I moved through my career, was how can I get scale? How can I delegate? How can I make my team better and grow and things like that? And I know it's taken a lot of work for me, a lot of intentionality. Was that something that you thought about? Because I'm guessing I'm going to take a shot in the dark and say you're probably a little type A too, if you're where you are right now. Is that something you've kind of focused on? And was there a moment where you realized this just isn't going to work anymore?
Yeah, Brian, it's a great point. I mean, of course it is. That's the hardest thing to do, in my opinion, in building a great company, is scaling it beyond the individual heroics of a few great employees. That's not the basis for a large scale company. That's the basis for a boutique firm. When you can attract and retain great people, that's really important at any size. But being able to take what you do and scale it out and show other people how to deliver those same results. And it's not to say that there's some magic formula that we've completely figured out. It's a mindset, mm-hmm. and trying to get everybody to follow and believe and do the things that we need to do to find the success that we want for our clients. Very difficult to scale that.
That makes sense. I mean, have you done that? How have you managed to kind of be in the role that you are, but also continue to keep your finger on the pulse of, I mean, I started thinking of a couple things, but in my head, I want to say like everything, like keep your finger on the pulse of the culture of your organization, what the people are doing, what the strategy is of the business now, what's the strategy going to be in the next 5 years? Because I'm seeing these type of technologies and these types of things come in. How do you stay abreast of all of that, make time for like the further reaching things versus the now? How does that work for you?
Yeah, it's all about intention to me. I've got to constantly remind myself of the things that I really should be spending my time on, and being very intentional about putting the time into that. It's so easy to dive into the weeds on any aspect of the business that's of interest to you. And for me, that's almost every part of the business is interesting to me. So it's very easy to do that. To me, having the right people around you, surrounding yourself with great people that can brief you and then accept some feedback and accept some ideation that I'm going to do on my own, and then be able to run with that and mold it and bring it back and have this great battle rhythm with your people, really makes a huge difference in your ability to jump from item to item to item, because it does feel like that. Every day I'm switching gears, switching context all day long. And then that leaves the downtime to think more long-term and to think more strategically. And I find myself doing that on business trips, on waiting in line at the store, it becomes almost an obsession. And being able to capture those thoughts requires some downtime during the week. And our board really keeps me honest on that. We have quarterly board meetings, and when those are rolling around, I know they're coming up. So even that's just part of the rhythm of the business. I know I've got this quarterly board meeting, and I know I've got to talk long-term strategy in that meeting as well. So there's a lot of checks and balances in the way at least our organization is designed. And I think most people design their companies that way.
I was just talking to somebody the other day. I mean, you mentioned capturing those ideas. It happens generally throughout the day, but my sort of intentional time is in the morning, and I'll work out, I'll go for walks, and I'll listen to podcasts or audiobooks and things. And that's when some of the things that are catalyzed by what I'm listening to sort of spur some type of thought. And for the longest time, I'm like, how do I capture these things? I don't want to lose it while I'm working out or running or walking or whatever. So now I always have my phone with me where I can write things down, take notes, and make sure that I don't lose those thoughts. Because I'm the same way. I get inspiration from everything, and I want to be able to capture that inspiration. And I think it's interesting too. Like as we think about government right now, I think especially the government technology landscape, we're seeing a period of time that we haven't really witnessed before. So you think about building a strategy for things that you've brought that experience to as a CEO. It's hard to do that. I mean, you can bring experience from ambiguous periods, things like that. But you guys also sort of bifurcate your business too, where you have government and commercial that you support. I'm guessing there's some lessons learned from that ambiguity that you can bring into government. How long have you guys been working in the government space, by the way, Larry?
The company started in 1982, and the first government contract was in 1985. I did not start the company, by the way. I started here as a software developer and held lots of different roles over the years, culminating with this role in 2020. So really, as a government contractor since 1985, but we didn't really become, in my view of the world, a true government contractor with multiple government contracts until 2004, 2005, about 4 years into my tenure here, where we created a federal team within AIS. We always had this one legacy contract, and that was great, but it was not an intentional focus on the federal government really until about 2004.
And what have you seen over that period of time? I mean, we're just over 20 years now that you've been kind of, as you say, very intentionally focused on the federal business. I mean, what are your thoughts on the ambiguity we're seeing right now? And is there a period that you remember that even kind of comes close or that you can compare it to?
Absolutely. COVID is the first thing that comes to mind. Sure. Prior to that was sequestration and the government shutdowns. All of those have very similar themes as what we're going through today, where you have to be disruptive. You have to think differently. The status quo is not going to work. And for AIS, for me personally, we've never been a traditional government contractor. So in some ways, I feel like we were created or born for these types of uncertain times. We love to challenge the status quo. We want to be the disruptors. And we often use emerging technology to try to shake things up and show that we can do more for less and be more efficient. So in many ways, I feel very well prepared for times like this.
That's awesome. And I also think too, you mentioned emerging technologies, and I feel like this administration in particular has an increased appetite to bring on some of the technologies around the programs that they find efficacy in around the government mission. So I think the accelerated pace in which we're going to see some of these technologies out there kind of being brought to bear and value realized in a very fast period of time is going to be really cool to be part of, especially artificial intelligence. I mean, AI has been around for a long time. And I mean, we've seen generative AI take off over the past couple of years for various reasons. I think one of the biggest reasons is people like my wife and my mother-in-law and other people have ChatGPT on their phones and they can see it. So when you can consumerize it, it makes it easier for people to digest. But I think we've seen that move and accelerate into government as well. What are some of the ways that you guys are leveraging technologies like AI, as you said, and others to be able to drive value within government right now?
Yeah, I'll say that I'll start with this administration and its appetite for technological change. I'm a believer that there's been great innovation in government all along. Being in a business that's half commercial and half federal, I've gotten to see what the Fortune 500 do, and I see what government does. And I do believe that there is a moment right now where everybody is going to try to capitalize on emerging technology. But I do think that the consensus or the thought that government is always behind is not always true. I think there's been a lot of great innovation in government over my 20 years in government service that rivals some of the Fortune 500 tech that we see. What's different about this administration and this moment may be the widespread push to break the barriers, whereas in the past, you were a bit of a rebel if you were doing it. When it comes to bringing transformative technology like artificial intelligence to government, the most obvious workload that we see is the massive amount of unstructured data that's out there that human beings can't possibly process or search quickly enough. And it has created this environment where this great technology landed and you can chatbot enable anything that's unstructured and arm people with this ability to quickly find things that they were looking for. And to me, what's groundbreaking about that is for 20 years, enterprise search has gotten incrementally better. In this just last couple of years, or really within a few months over the past 2 years, we saw this radical change to how you can interact with this unstructured data. So that, to me, there's this unbelievable opportunity for this, I'll say system one, this quick response, not really deliberately long thought out processing use of AI to just quickly get the information out of the voluminous amounts of data that the government has into the hands of the people that need it to make decisions. The challenging part of that is not enabling the tech. We all know how to do that. We've got great tools coming out. Every week it's changing, but it's doing so and ensuring that the data that's being surfaced is the right data to guide those users that are making these just-in-time decisions. And now they're going to use all this unstructured data that's been sitting out there for many years. And you've got to make sure that that's the content that you really want your users focused on. To me, that's the hidden work that needs to be done in enabling the effective AI in government when you think of those system one chatbot-like interfaces.
Yeah, I like how you pulled in chatbot and also enterprise search, because I think for a long time, people hear chatbot and they think of external websites, and you go and you can land on whatever company you want to go ask a question to. And instead of getting a human, I personally for a long time would just click the X because I knew the chatbot wasn't going to be great. Now I will start there because I know it's probably leveraging some type of generative AI, and it's probably going to actually get to my resolution faster than it's going to take me to get a human to actually come online and speak to me or get him on the phone. And taking that type of interface and layering it into sort of a internal capacity where you can search your enterprise for information within all that unstructured data, like you say, because there's massive amounts of unstructured data within government, right? They are the greatest creators, disseminators, consumers of data, but being able to use it, not just be sort of custodians of the data, has been the biggest challenge. So I think AI has certainly helped them. How have you seen the way the workforce has approached using some of these technologies and the way government has looked at not just the reskilling aspect of it? I mean, obviously, that is a conversation when you're looking at like a massive transformational change, but just the adoption of certain things. I think when we were during our COVID period, adoption of technology became much easier. And I say that because there was really a draconian necessity. You couldn't do your job without things like Teams or Zoom or whatever, and remote work type of capabilities that were enabled through technology. So adoption had to happen. How have you seen now in the period that we're in, government focus strategically on the adoption of some of this technology to make sure that they are realizing this value across their enterprise?
I think you mentioned it earlier, the consumerization of technology always seems to be how any revolutionary or even evolutionary tech gets deployed in the enterprise. Once we have it in our home lives, the employees of an organization are going to demand it in their work lives. And if the organization doesn't give it to them, they're going to use it anyway. They're just not going to move it in a safe, secure manner. They're going to go and say, it won't be secure. That's right. They'll go out on the internet and start using ChatGPT or whatever flavor of AI that you want to use. And they're going to take your enterprise data and put it out there. So for me, the most immediate thing that government ought to be focused on is enabling safe sandbox environments for people to explore this technology without risking data integrity and data security and confidentiality. And of course, when it comes to national security and classified information, you're only increasing the amount of vigilance that's required to ensure that employees aren't going rogue and using these consumer products in a way that they weren't designed to be used. So I think that's the first step in this for government. And what I generally see is more of an approach that we often see where they want to control it and try to build walled gardens around it and slow roll adoption in the name of security, which to me is dangerous because, again, you get that rogue use of it where it can actually hurt the security posture by waiting to deploy it. So I think the more progressive way to do this is to ensure that you've created safe environments for people to use it and allow them to find potentially bad data that's in the repository that's being searched or used to train the models, and ensuring that there's some way to do something about that bad data. We know it's out there. Just further hiding it is not the answer. You've got to be able to expose that and fix it in real time. So like any new technology, there's so much to do all at once. It can be overwhelming and you're not sure where to start. And I think the answer is you have to start everywhere.
Something you said earlier, I completely agree with. The innovation has been happening in government. I think being able to tell that story has been a huge challenge. And that's a conversation for another podcast. But the innovation is certainly there. And I think when I think about the appetite around accelerated deployment for this administration, one of the things that I think about is their willingness to almost over-rotate, but in a positive way, into, hey, what are you guys doing over there in the private sector that we can leverage, right? How can we use that technology? How can we procure it faster, get it online, and start seeing value from it now? And I think some of those private sector use cases or the ability to show private sector moving into public sector has worked in some areas, hasn't worked in others, but I think they really want to see it work in a cohesive way. And knowing that you guys do have a government and commercial business, is there ways that you've done over the past, again, we'll say the past 20 years, is there ways that you've been successful and would be willing to share on bringing in those private sector use cases to show government what is really possible in a way that they haven't seen before and actually been able to deploy that in a successful way?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that to me is part of the value proposition of working with a company like ours, is we do take these private sector lessons learned and bring them to government. We used to say we innovate in commercial and we scale in government. That's not entirely true, because I do want to acknowledge that we also innovate a lot in government. But if I go back and I think about cloud, I remember the very first workload we ever deployed in government in cloud, I think was in 2009, where we took a test lab, a development and test lab, and virtualized it in Azure government. It was the first use of Azure government that we were aware of. That was something that we literally built based on the knowledge that we had gained from doing this with a Fortune 50 company. So that while it was the first time we were doing it in government, it wasn't the very first time we were doing it. And when the GovCloud regions started popping up for both AWS or Azure, the two first hyperscalers out there, finding companies with experience in that was challenging, because the government was not yet using it until they had these special versions designed for them. What we brought to the table was that experience in these large enterprises, because they were commercial, because it was designed for them first. And while I, again, will say that in government, we see a lot of good innovation, and I will always say it feels like a false statement to say that there is no innovation. Fortune 500 companies have similar challenges as government agencies in that there's a lot of risk for a Fortune 500 company to quickly adopt a brand new technology. So some of where we see the most innovative work are in smaller startup clients that we have or mid-sized clients that we have. So what really makes our experience unique is we work in all of those markets. While the bulk of our work is in enterprise accounts, we always take on smaller accounts that are using emerging technology so we can learn where all the sharp edges are and not cut ourselves when the implications of getting a cut would be so much worse in these large enterprise, highly regulated industries.
I do a lot of work with the G20 Global Smart City Alliance as an advisor. And one thing people are always really surprised to hear is that some of the most innovative things happening are in some of the smaller cities around the world, not your New York's or San Francisco's or London's or whatever. It's actually happening in like Columbus, Ohio or Chattanooga, Tennessee, where you can build innovative things at a quicker rate. There's less bureaucracy to kind of push things through, and there's less of a risk because there's less constituency to have to drive adoption around, right? You can test it out in pockets versus like large scale deployments. So I totally agree. I think some of the most innovative things are happening not only at small cities, but also small businesses. And there's also, again, that B word, bureaucracy within the private sector too, within Fortune 500 companies. That is also a challenge. How have you, again, navigating government, navigating commercial, especially scaled out commercial, how have you learned how to navigate some of those things, especially bureaucracy and red tape and things like that to not only drive adoption, but also get awareness of how you guys can really drive value for the customer?
Yeah, I think the, I will say, first of all, I totally agree where the small city analogy is perfect because you have these innovative labs, if you will, where you've got some reduced risk, some reduced bureaucracy, some reduced burden. One of the beautiful things of cloud computing, though, really changed the game is you don't have to make a huge, significant upfront investment to get started. You don't have to buy servers and buy licenses and sign a 3-year agreement. You're paying by the hour or by the minute. You're standing things up very quickly with very little capital, if any, capital investment or long-term commitment. So it's really changed the game across the board where you can try new things and be very innovative without massive financial risk or regulatory risk. When it comes to being a change agent or disrupting the status quo, our formula is usually the same. It always involves a champion that's already with the organization. We're consultants, so we are outsiders, and we can be those disruptive change agents, but we need a partner on the inside. So the first thing we do is look for that partner. Once we're doing work with a customer who has the big ideas that they need help shaping and justifying to the executive management or to wherever the blocker is, if whoever's concerned about whatever is new that we're going to use, the main goal that we always have is to engage with them and teach each other. We need to learn from them what their concerns are and show them how we can address those concerns and still do this in a safe manner. It's not about running people over. It's about bringing them along and showing them, well, this can be done in a safe way. Oh, and by the way, by not using it, you get that the thing we talked about earlier, where if you're not providing the tools to the people, they're going to find the tools anyway as the tech gets consumerized and more often than not comes out for consumers first these days. You know, gone are the days where I feel like, what's it called on Mondays after Thanksgiving when people go shopping? Cyber Monday?
Oh, Cyber Monday, yeah.
All right, didn't that start because originally to get internet access, you typically went to work? But by the time we had mobile phones, it was the opposite. You got your consumer goods first, and then your companies adopted them and government agencies adopted them later. With that total flip, one of the ways that you engage with skeptics or people that are more focused on risk management maybe than innovation is talk about the risks of not moving.
No, that makes a lot of sense. Have you seen patterns across the concerns that you were talking about when you're sitting there, you're having these conversations, understanding their concerns? What commonalities are you generally seeing that you need to address?
It always starts with security, Always. And I feel the same way now as CEO of AIS. My first question for internal adoption of technology is security. We're always worried about cyber threats to not just us, but our customers. So security, governance, adhering to regulations, that always is number one. I think number two is an area that, frankly, in my younger part of my career, I may have misunderstood, is change management. Making sure that as you unleash new technology on people, they're not overwhelmed by it, that it truly does empower them. And that takes some work to ensure that you are walking people through how to use the new technology, certainly the end users, but also the people that are going to have to maintain it, because that's always a top concern too. Great, we have a new piece of tech. We built something around it. Now people are relying on it. The moment it goes down, it becomes a huge problem. So maintainability and operability and operational readiness become major concerns for our clients as well whenever they're adopting something new. And I think the last one that I would throw out there is this the right tech for us to invest in? Is this still going to be around in 2 or 3 years once we build something on it? Will the vendor continue to support it? Is always something that people are thinking about when it comes to new technology.
Yeah, I think, I mean, change management is interesting, right? Because anybody who works in this space understands the need for some sort of viable partner ecosystem. And I think one of the challenges with needing that partner ecosystem is sometimes it can put a little bit of separation between the technology and potentially the implementer. Or the person trying to drive adoption around it. How have you worked to make sure that you guys have closed that gap if and when you are using a partner that might be part of that implementation? How have you continued to be that trusted partner for government and make sure that their needs are getting addressed through what you know you can provide as a company?
Yeah, Brian, we always focus, and we have to focus on ensuring that our advice to our clients is true, honest, unbiased advice. And let's face it, that's hard to do. We are teamed up. We're a Microsoft partner. Most everything we do is building on the Microsoft cloud platform. And that's not to say that's the only thing we do, because once you're in the platform, of course, it's a heterogeneous environment. There's all sorts of different services that you can choose to run, native Azure services or third-party services. And we're often in the room with the customer, helping them sort through, should I use a native service from Azure or should I use a third-party service that's out there? And obviously, when you're working with partners, everybody is trying to push their agendas, and including AIS, right? We're a business and that can creep in. So we always train our consultants to step back and put yourself in the shoes of the customer. And even if that means we don't get to do the work because the right solution is not one that's in our area of focus, that's okay. We should be the right, do what's right for the customer, and they will reward you later with different work. If you don't do what's right for them, they'll never give you any work again. So you've just got to keep a long-term view on that and make sure that you're not overemphasizing the right solution for us as opposed to the right solution for the customer. And it's easy to say and harder to do. So we've tried to build in some checks and balances. We do our own version of gate reviews. We have technical directors in each of our business units, and they're all designed to make sure that what we're proposing is sound and reasonable and aligned with the long-term roadmap, even with our selected providers, because we don't want to pick a technology that we're not sure Microsoft or some other third-party provider is really committed to for the long haul. Because after all, it's our reputation on the line that we brought in that technology. So it takes a good amount of research and engagement with the companies that we team with, and particularly Microsoft as our biggest partner. We soak up everything they put out. We join every program. We do every piece of investment we possibly can. For instance, when Azure OpenAI was released, we immediately tore into it, came up with ideas for a project, funded a project so that we could discover internally how does this really work before we start using it with our customers.
Well, Larry, your worry at the beginning of the episode was absolutely unfounded. I've absolutely loved this conversation. I appreciate you coming on, and thank you so much for your authenticity as a CEO and as a leader in this industry. Any final thoughts as we close out today?
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity, Brian. It's a great time to be in this business. I know that it's turbulent right now in the government contracting business, but when you think about what is going on with this shift in artificial intelligence, it's hard to overhype something like this. And at the risk of sounding like I am, it feels like, and it's certainly out there from others, that this is as big as the internet and it's as big as mobile. I think what's truly going to be exciting about artificial intelligence for government is when we get to this system two thinking, these long-running processes that are doing magical things that people used to have to do that they no longer have to do, that are very time consuming. So unlike the chatbot, they're not just giving you answers that are in your unstructured data. These system two level workloads, where we're really doing game-changing features in applications that already exist, it's going to be a great time to be doing IT services, whether it's government or commercial. And in government especially, I think there's so much opportunity for innovation, and I just can't wait to get to it.
I agree. First of all, I love that. I love the optimism. I've been saying this for the past few weeks now that, I mean, we're sort of part of and at the ground floor of how digital governance is going to be viewed and rolled out over for the future. And I think it's just a cool opportunity, a cool moment in history that we get to work in this space and be able to be part of this. So I'm absolutely loving being in the space right now. And Larry, absolutely love this conversation with you too. So thank you again for joining us today.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it.
This has been the Government Huddle podcast. You can check out more episodes of the show by heading over to governmenthuddle.com or wherever you access your podcast. And feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn or Twitter @ShittistRayB. Thanks for listening, guys. Bye for now.